It's an art that deserves gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Never giving up the fight on your Thursday morning with lots to do today, or lots to hear anyway. We've got Air Cascadia coming your way at 10 o'clock this morning with host Chris Andre presenting headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. Today, we'll hear the latest news about Texas and their most restrictive abortion legislation to date, HB2. We'll talk about recent revelations by Caitlyn Jenner, and we'll hear part 13 of our series, The Battle for Public Education. At 11, we'll hear Between the Covers with host Lisa Loving. Today's guest is Stacy Wakefield, author of the new novel, The Sunshine Crust Baking Factory. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures with host SW Conser. Today's guest is local artist Philip Barash, who exhibits his large-scale oil paintings at Portland Area Galleries and Industrial Spaces, then adapts the panels into card sets and sequential narratives. That is all coming up this morning. Up next, it's an hour-long edition of Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell. Stick around for all the news you're not supposed to know. It's KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is accepting Toys for a Toy Drive conducted by McLaren's leadership in collaboration with McLaren Community Voice. The toys will be used during family visits for young family members visiting their loved ones in the McLaren Youth Authority. KBOO will have a barrel in their lobby from June 2nd to the 14th and will accept toys, stuffed animals in new or gently used condition. We will not turn down any donations. Your donations will be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Well, as Engineer Rock was saying, I've got an hour here. And I'm hoping to hear from you, and this morning I'm particularly hoping to hear from women, and you'll understand why in a few minutes, as I'm going to bring up a certain article in the New York Times about transgendered women. You may have read it, but we'll have plenty to say about that. But first, I want to go over some headlines, things that got my attention. I got an email from watchdog.net. And there are a lot of groups, a lot of little groups, and when I say little, I really mean groups that don't have billionaire funding, and trying to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the so-called trade deal, which is actually an effort to destroy national sovereignty and to wipe out your rights in favor of that of multinational corporations. That's not an exaggeration. That's just what they are doing. It is a massive effort in the ongoing effort the ongoing war against people in all forms on behalf of billionaires. And billionaires would like for pesky nation states like the United States, like you, like state of Oregon, like city of Portland, get the hell out of their way. And they want to set it up secretly, swiftly, under color of law. And that's what TPP is about. And that's why you can't read the TPP. Only certain members of Congress and their staff can go in and read it. And they're not allowed to write it down, much less photocopy it. They can't get it on their computers. They're just treated like suspicious little kids. You're allowed to go into the principal's office and see the policies, but they can't talk about it. And that right there should tell you just how far down the flush hole these things have gone. Anyway, the email from watchdog.net says, what good could possibly come out of a multinational trade agreement negotiated entirely behind closed doors with representatives of some of the biggest corporations in the world? Well, what we've seen from recent TPP leaks isn't pretty. It would give corporations the power to decide our laws on everything from keeping the internet free to access to affordable medicines, undermine financial reform, open up our local and national governments to corporate lawsuits. I'm going to depart from the text there. For example, let's say your municipality decides you need a hospital. Well, not under the TPP. You can't just go and put a hospital in. That's not your business. It's the TPP's business, the big dogs, because they want you to know under the terms, and this is what has been leaked, you put in a hospital and they think that maybe they could have, would have, should have put in a hospital themselves for profit, then they have the right to sue your municipal government for the profits that they might have lost from their for-profit hospital if you dare to put in your own hospital. That's how insane, that's how totalitarian it is. The TPP is the totalitarian trade protocol. Have no doubt. Anyway, returning to the text, that is why proponents of the bill, like President Obama, are pressing for the House to vote on fast-track trade negotiating authority, essentially a vote to pre-approve the bill as soon as tomorrow if they have their way. Fast track would signal to negotiators that the TPP is clear for approval without the bothersome intervention of the very people elected to representatives. So, you know what to do. You can find your representatives right there on the web. You can even start with a search like, who's my representative? So I'm not going to give you names and numbers right now on KBOO. KBOO Portland, People's Community Radio. You look it up and tell them. Tell them. Okay, now moving subjects on to more headlines. Democracy Now! Had this two-sentence report by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reveals Israel recently detonated a series of so-called dirty bombs laced with nuclear material, purportedly to test the potential impact of a radioactive attack. The so-called Greenfield Project involved 20 detonations, most of them in the desert over 4 years, ending in 2014. What? Huh? So, I used a search engine, found something from the People's Voice by Stephen Lindman. He writes, dirty bombs are radiological weapons containing radioactive material with conventional explosives. On detonation, they contaminate the affected area. The U.S. Energy Department says radiation exposure is fairly high, but not fatal. Which is typical for them to say, since if you get a tumor, you know, 5, 10, 20 years later in your lungs or bones, then it doesn't pop up with a little tag that says, you know, dirty bomb 2015 or anything else. This is what the nuclear industry gets away with. It's what the nuclear weapons industry gets away with. But anyway, nuclear expert Helen Caldicott, this is Stephen Lindman's writing again, explains no amount of radiation is safe and amounts exposed to are cumulative. They stack up in your body. Cell mutations result, causing cancer and other diseases. The difference between dirty bombs and nuclear ones is the latter ones are hugely destructive and kill large numbers of people instantly. The harmful effects of dirty bombs take time to develop, making it easy to attribute later illnesses and deaths to other causes. Haaretz and then other Israeli media reported that the IDF conducted dirty bomb tests in the Negev Desert to test their impact. Now, have a look at the map of Israel. How much desert do they have there? Is that like the Mojave? You think maybe someone got contaminated? Well, returning to the text, possible harmful effects on nearby Bedouin Arab communities weren't mentioned. But who cares about them, right? Sorry. I'll calm down. Returning to the text, the Negev is home to about 200,000 Bedouins. Communities close to where detonations occurred were subjected to low-level radiation exposure, leaving them vulnerable to later diseases and possible death. Tests conducted followed a similar so-called Greenfield project at Israel's Dimona nuclear reactor used to produce nuclear weapons. The whole world knows what Israel won't officially acknowledge. Recent Israeli dirty bomb tests involved 19 open-air detonations and one at a closed facility. They tested 250 grams to 25 kilograms of explosives mixed with radioactive material used for medical imaging. Nasty, huh? This is Press Watch on KBOO Portland. The Shanghai Daily has reported that about 800 terabecquerels of cesium-137 is going to reach the west coast of America by next year, equivalent to 5% of the total cesium discharged to the Pacific Ocean after the Fukushima nuclear disaster. That's according to Michio Aoyama, a professor at Fukushima University, quoted by Kyoto news agency. However, the cesium levels detected at U.S. beaches were 1 to 2 becquerels per cubic meter, much lower than the safety limit. Speaking for myself, higher levels have been detected more recently. What's happening is that huge amount of radiation is coming over here. We will first see very, very small, and we are seeing very, very small amounts of radiation, which will rise and rise and rise and rise and rise. The West Coast samples with Fukushima radioactive material have contained levels several times the amount I was mentioning. Off the coast of California, levels were 8.6 becquerels per cubic meter. Levels on Vancouver Island were 7.2 becquerels per cubic meter, and it's just going up. Yama said, we and our collaborators continued to collect seawater samples in 2013 and 2014 in the North Pacific. The cesium-137 activity through the end of September 2014 remains higher than expected, implying continued releases from the reactors. And departing from that text again, cesium is being tracked because so little, cesium only is being tracked because so little money is allowed, especially from the U.S. The U.S. does not want to know what's happening. So little money is allowed for research, for testing, that private concerns have picked up the slack. Not all the slack, not the amount of slack that the U.S. government has left laying around, if I may continue that metaphor, but Woods Oceanographic Institute is testing for radiation, and that's because the U.S. government just isn't your friend. Not unless you've got $1 billion in your pocket. And as I say that, radiation's going to get worse and worse, and they're not testing for strontium or tellurium, just the cesium, just trying to keep things to the minimum. But strontium doesn't care. Strontium's coming here. Strontium will get into you. Turning to globalresearch.ca, the figures and the statistics regarding the humanitarian situation in Gaza have never been shocking, as is the case in these days, as they unveil the miserable lives of about 2 million citizens, which may lead to what Palestinian observers call an explosion. And Mr. Qasem, a Palestinian writer and professor of political science at Birzeit University in Ramallah, told Anadolu News Agency the humanitarian situation in Gaza has, quote, reached an unprecedented level of deterioration. Alarming numbers issued by international institutions warn of rising unemployment rates and poverty in conjunction with a lack of any political solution in sight and the delayed reconstruction process of Gaza. We are talking about a ticking bomb of anger and despair that might explode at any moment. He also warned people in Gaza feel like they have nothing to lose, which may prompt them to explode and revolt against the Egyptian siege, Israel, and the different factions that rule them. And I bring this up because there are Israeli citizens right now listening to me, and your voice has a great deal more impact than mine does on the Israeli government. I suggest you call your friends, if you have any friends in Likud, and gently chew them out, because things have to change, don't they? I mean, unless you're just okay with us. Gaza is on the brink of collapse, Maher al-Ataba, a Palestinian economist, added, saying, life in Gaza is worse than people can imagine. It has been turned into the biggest prison in the world, and clarified, Gaza is in a state of clinical death. No reconstruction, no crossings, no water, no electricity, no work, no medicine, no development. There is no life at all, he called for, necessarily pressuring Israel into lifting the siege. And it is a siege. And it's funded by American tax money. So even if you're not Jewish, you can have a lot of effect on this. Something to talk to your representatives about. Something to blog about. Something to mention on press, on Facebook. By the way, I'm on Facebook. I'm using First Name Press, Last Name Watch. That's initially because I just didn't know what I was doing. And now it's a little bit of an inside joke. I listed my age as 20 years older than I actually am. I've been having fun with it. But if you want to pull that up, you'll find me. And then I understand you have to like it. And then I have to click the like or something like that. And I'm pretty slow about it. But I'll try to add in anyone who wants to read what I'm putting on Facebook. Excuse me. But right now you're not on Facebook. You're either on KBOO.FM or you're on 90.7 or one of the other frequencies that we broadcast on terrestrially. Turning to the climate, scientists on Tuesday, according to Agence France-Presse, called for action to defuse a time bomb of Arctic greenhouse gas, they mean methane, as negotiators at UN talks grappled over a climate rescue pact. Releasing the methane will create a vicious cycle in the Earth's global warming problem. And that's according to Susan Natale of the Woods Hole Research Center in Massachusetts. About 1,500 billion tons of heat-trapping carbon gas are estimated to be locked in the permafrost, which is thawing as the climate warms, according to new research. The estimated amount of methane in permafrost, perennially frozen ground covering about a quarter of exposed land in the northern hemispheres, represents about twice the volume currently in the atmosphere, she said. I am replacing the word carbon with methane because that's what they're talking about, and I want to be clear. We're talking about the methane bomb here. We're talking about the methane catastrophe. Emissions from permafrost could lead to out-of-control global warming, according to a presentation on the sidelines of 11-day climate talks in Bonn. Country negotiators in the former West German capital are seeking to streamline a draft global climate pact for adoption at a UN conference in Paris in December, but they disagree on how, and delegates say the meeting that opened last Monday has been taken up by technical squabbling. There are just 2 days of talk left and over 6 months before the deadline for signing the final agreement, which will seek to meet the UN goal of limiting overall global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. We are advancing, said Gabriel Quijandria, but not at the speed we would have liked. And Jennifer Morgan of World Resources Policy Institute said everybody is concerned that the process needs to be quicker. The need for urgency was underlined by Natale, who pointed out that even in a 2-degree centigrade scenario, the research pointed to a 30% loss of permafrost by 2100, up to 70%, assuming emissions continue on their current trajectory. The actions that we now take in terms of our fossil fuel emissions are going to have a significant impact on how much permafrost is lost and in turn how much carbon is released from permafrost. There's a further warning from Ricardo Winkelmann of the Potsdam Center for Climate Research in Germany of dramatic sea level rise as a result of Antarctic ice melt. In some places, she said, the ice thickness actually exceeds 4,000 meters, which is about as much as 10 times the Empire State Building stacked on each other. If you take that ice volume, and distribute it over the entire ocean, then sea level would rise globally by 5 meters, that's 16 feet, for the West Antarctic ice sheet, and by 50 meters for the East Antarctic ice sheet. In other words, each of those melting would raise the ocean by that much. So there's more on that article at Agence France-Presse. From E360 Digest, U.S. homeowners installed more solar power systems in the first 3 months of this year than in any other previous quarter, according to data from the Solar Energy Industries Association, a trade group for the U.S. solar sector. Pardon me. I mentioned this, by the way, I'm already departing from that article, because solar has gotten cheap. I mean, you really don't have to pay the utility company at this point. Even if you don't want to save up some cash and have your own solar panels, pardon me, you can simply lease them. The deal can be made. You can make it happen. I intend to make it happen on my house within the next year if I possibly can. Returning to the article, the first quarter of any given year typically sees the fewest solar installations because of winter weather, but the period from January through March of this year saw a solid increase over last quarter. That's 11%, and a 76% increase over the same period last year. So, speaking for myself, solar is roaring, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper. Returning to the article, the average cost for a residential solar system is now $3.48 per watt, or 10% lower than this time last year. It notes that cumulatively through the first quarter of 2015, nearly one-fourth of all residential solar installations in the U.S. have now come online without any state incentives. And as I've mentioned before, and this is just me, the Koch brothers are going around to and using ALEC and going to the state legislatures and trying to tack on a tax, make you pay every month additional if you put solar on. And you have to watch for this, because they are constantly, I mean, they have the money to constantly fly in and see your representatives to press their agenda. And if they can at all, then they'll apply a tax in the state of Oregon, as they have in other states, so that you will be punished for putting on solar power. They don't want that, because the Koch brothers are oil investors. They're into oil pipelines and oil, and you know, anything that gets less money to them just makes them see red. The time is 9:20. You're listening to Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and now I'm going to turn to transgender rights, and I'm going to do this because I am transgender. And I'm going to do this because the whole opening of the spectrum of human orientation and sexuality has been very healthy for this society. And I'm going to do this because there's a backlash a-brewing big time, not just against transgender, although that's the point right now, especially with the Republican Party. It seems that no candidate for president thinks that he can manage to get the proper constituency without utterly trashing transgender people and trans women in particular. And I'm feeling it. I'm also a bus driver. I go out and drive my bus around, and I can tell when there's an agenda cooking up, because people talk to me, or they yell at me, or they spit at me. They threaten violence. These things get worse under these circumstances, so scapegoating is about to happen. And an article by Eleanor Burkett in the New York Times is adding to this. It seeks to roll back psychoneuroendocrinological research of the past two decades. And it wants to assert, Eleanor Burkett wants to assert, that trans women like Caitlyn Jenner and Chelsea Manning and myself are just deluded males responding to pseudoscience in an effort to build their own dignity by trampling on woman's dignity. She writes, "People who haven't lived their whole lives as women shouldn't get to define us. That's something men have been doing for much too long, and much as I recognize and endorse the right of men to throw off the mantle of maleness, they cannot stake their claim to dignity by trampling on mine as a woman." That's a quote. Well, that's pretty loaded. Let me just take that apart a little bit. In the first place, the way this is phrased, it makes it clear people who haven't lived their whole lives as women and men are the same in the sentence. Men are trying to throw off the mantle of maleness, staking their claim to dignity by trampling on women's dignity. Okay, I may sound male, but I was born trans and I've lived as a woman since 2001. And so she's talking about people like me, and she's saying that I'm a man, and that trans women are men, and that's, you know, underlying the sentences. And she's saying that somehow my claim to dignity hurts her. Does that sound familiar? I'm going to unpack that part in a minute too. But the entire article is laden with such insidious implications. Note that by phrasing her complaint in that way, Eleanor Burkett has indeed labeled trans women as men, and it has asserted that somehow by existing openly as trans women, Burkett and all women have lost their dignity. In this, she echoes the wails of the religious marriage fanatics, who would have you believe that their lives are polluted and violated if the franchise of marriage is extended to gays and lesbians. The sacredness of their marriages, evangelicals' marriages, which is daily trampled by their own divorces, has somehow made profane because someone different from them can also get married. Make sense? In this way, if I or Chelsea Manning or Caitlyn Jenner are viewed as women, Eleanor Burkett is harmed. It's sort of like a violation of copyright that she owns, or an unlicensed knockoff of her artistic product, womanhood. This is silly, of course. And in fact, this sort of dramatic objection is really used to mask resentment and bigotry. Evangelicals hate gays and lesbians for scoffing at religious controls on social norms. Hate them for being out of control. And trans-excluding radical feminists, that's T-E-R-F or TERF, like Burkett, are really just trying to put a shine on their misplaced resentment of trans women. Also, she's just scientifically wrong. This information from WebMD, How Male and Female Brains Differ. Recent studies highlight a long-held suspicion about the brains of males and females. They're not the same. So how does the brain of a female look and function differently from a male's brain? And what accounts for these differences? And speaking for myself, this knowledge comes not just from surgery, but from positron emission tomography. Returning to the article, scientists now know that sex hormones begin to exert their influence during the development of the fetus. A recent study by Israeli researchers that examined male and female brains found distinct differences in the developing fetus at just 26 weeks of pregnancy. The disparities could be seen when using an ultrasound scanner. The corpus callosum, the bridge of nerve tissue that connects the right and left sides of the brain, had thicker measurement in female fetuses than in male fetuses. Observation of adult brains show that this area may remain stronger in females. Females seem to have language functioning on both sides of the brain. According to Martha Denkla, a PhD research scientist at Kennedy Krieger Institute. Consider these recent findings. Researchers using brain imaging technology that captures blood flow to working parts of the brain analyzed how men and women process language. All subjects listened to a novel. When males listened, only the left hemisphere of the brains was activated. The brains of female subjects, however, showed activity on the left and right hemispheres. This activity across both hemispheres of the brain may result in strong language skills typically displayed by females. If there's more area dedicated to a set of skills, it follows that the skills will be more refined, said David Geary, PhD, professor of psychological sciences at the University of Missouri. And there's more on that at WebMD. But Burkett calls this sort of research statement the kind of nonsense that was used to repress women for centuries, end quote. But it isn't. It's modern research. Pseudoscience, like the idea that women were emotionally weaker, was used to repress women for centuries. Psychoneuroendocrinology is just brain science. It doesn't have an agenda. Perhaps you've noticed that I am rather clever and articulate for someone who was brought up a guy. Well, turn then to NCBI in the National Institutes of Health websites, and again from PubMed, research by Creever, Zhao, Poole, Hoffman, Gurin, and Swab. The abstract reads, transsexuals experience themselves as being of the opposite sex. By the way, it says transsexuals because this research has been around for more than a decade. But returning to the text, despite having the biological characteristics of one sex, a crucial question resulting from a previous brain study in male-to-female transsexuals was whether the reported difference according to gender identity in the central part of the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis was based on a neuronal difference in the BSTC itself or just a reflection of a difference in vasoactive intestinal polypeptide innervation from the amygdala, which was used as a marker. Pardon me for all the technicality, but we'll get to the meat of it in just a moment. Therefore, we determined in 42 subjects the number of somatostatin-expressing neurons in the BSTC in relation to sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, and past or present hormonal status. Regardless of sexual orientation, men had almost twice as many somatostatin neurons as women in that area. The number of neurons in the BSTC of male-to-female transsexuals was similar to that of the females. 42 subjects, brain female. In contrast, the neuron number of the female-to-male transsexual was found to be in the male range. Hormone treatment or sex hormone level variations in adulthood did not seem to have influenced BSTC neuron numbers. So in other words, female brain, born with it. Woman in a man's body? Well, let's dig in there and do a little brain surgery and science. Oh, yes. Science. Returning to the article, the present findings of somatostatin neuronal sex differences in the BSTC and its sex reversal in transsexual brain clearly support the paradigm that in transsexuals, sexual differentiation of the brain, and genitals may go in opposite directions and point to a neurobiological basis of gender identity disorder. I suppose you can hear my voice. I'm getting a little worked up about this because I, silly me, more than a decade ago when this came out, I thought, oh, this is it. Okay, thank you, finally. End of argument. Well, no, it's not. Of course it's not. What if facts matter? I want your comments and questions, and I especially want to hear from women. Because, and I want to hear from women who take the TERF side, because generally when I read what TERFs have to say, I find myself agreeing with just about everything right up until I get to the point where I don't get to use the restroom. Just about everything except for that one thing. And the old attitude, which was based on the science available at the time 20 years ago, was that gender is entirely learned, just entirely. And, you know, I find myself agreeing it's just, you know, I would say it's 98% learned. But there's differences. Important. That last 2% is very important. And so I have TERFs like this writer for the New York Times coming out and saying these things. And it gets worse. Miss Burkett's rant becomes more pointed further down in the New York Times article as she asserts that whereas she would like to show solidarity towards trans women, she cannot abide the attack that trans women represent, diluting and erasing the experiences and the indignities, her phrase, that she has experienced as a woman. She attempts to reassert that gender thus cannot be found in the brain, as if trans women were unaware of the fact that we become more women in the years that we experience womanhood, that our brains are thus destined to be shaped in exactly the same ways. Minus girlhood, of course. There's an underlying assumption in the article that trans women are unaware that girlhood experiences are important to alien... Excuse me. You know, that was a trans... That was a Freudian slip there. Just alien just popped in there. Important to what women become, as if we had not suffered the mind-bending anguish of being raised as an inappropriate gender. As if we had not been alienated from our own sisters and would-be friends, as if, to be more specific, as if trans women were merely bizarre, opportunistic, and let us say perverted men, because that's clearly the implication, who merely wish to arrogate the experience of women. She doubles down on this tale of resentment by saying, imagine the reaction if a young white man suddenly declared that he was trapped in the wrong body and after using chemicals to change his skin pigmentation and crocheting his hair into twists, expected to be embraced by the black community, end quote. Yeah, she actually went there. She actually wrote that, so I'm going to take it at face value. Imagine such a thing had happened. Actually, there's a book called Black Like Me, and someone tried that, but it wasn't really to fit in. It was just to do research. But anyway, one might expect the changeling to be rejected as a deluded fraud. Indeed, there are reasons for this. First, race is not gender. Second, such a transformation would not have a body of medical research showing that it was a manifestation of a condition historically produced by brain variation. Thirdly, there is no such brain variation. Pigmentation of the skin is not and cannot be an indicator of cranial configurations or mental capacity. But she speaks of offense. Number to call 503-231-8187. Miss Burkett names some silly episodes in which college students have gone too far with attempts at accommodation, erasing the word vagina from women's events. No doubt these incidents were annoying, and I certainly disagree with going that far. You know, if it's time for all owners of vaginas to get together, you ask me, and just about any trans woman you want to find, they feel better doing that. More power to them. But she fails to undergird her main assertion that she and all women are harmed by the existence of trans women. She ends with a slap at Jenner, saying that being a woman is more than painting one's nails. I must respond that being a woman is more than nurturing resentment. Your calls and questions and comments, 503-231-8187, and John's on the air. Okay, Emma's on the air.
Hi, Teresa. This is Emma. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Yeah, I thank you for bringing this up. This is a really important issue. I just wanted to, like, let you know, Teresa, and let everyone in the community know that we are having the Trans March and Rally tomorrow, Saturday, and we want to invite
all four
people
of us
to come out and to talk about it. It's going to be at the North Park Blocks at 8th and Burnside, starting at 2 o'clock. We're going to have lots of trans speakers, and we're expecting over 1,000 people this year.
Wow.
So I hope you can make it.
Thanks so much for that information. Can you repeat the details?
So we're having the Trans Pride March and Rally on Saturday, June 13th, beginning at 2 p.m. in the North Park Blocks at 8th and Burnside.
Okay, thank you very much. No, I'll be out of town, can't join you, but more power to you, and thank you.
Thank you.
Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I say that Ms. Burkett is wrong and that transgender women are not harming women generally. What do you say? 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I have, of course, pardon me, I would not denigrate 1 second for anyone of the powerful oppression that women feel around the world. And one of the things, and I've mentioned this before, that is not addressed directly when we are speaking of transgender women, and for example, my appearance in the local gym, women's gym locker, is that where trans women are perceived as men, there is the fear of rape. This is understandable. Rape happens. Rape is not reported as often as it happens. It's I don't even know where to start. It's so insidious. Rape is the enforcement arm of patriarchy. And when I walk into the gym locker, I go out of my way to be reassuring, either not to contact anyone who looks nervous or to, you know, be reassuring outside that that area with people that I see are going to go in there, women who I see who are going to go in there, because I don't want them to feel that fear, even if I feel that it is, you know, misplaced in my case. Rape is a context, and it isn't mentioned in Ms. Burkett's article, but it is part of what is driving the resentment. The idea that transgender women can use women's bathrooms is brought up continually, and the evangelical right knows very well that this is a flashpoint, that it's not something people can easily think out. It's something that has to be resolved simply by experience and by deconditioning of the idea. And so this is one of the reasons, pardon me, that I object so strongly when I see Eleanor Burkett. She doesn't come out and say in a sentence that transgender women are men, but she unmistakably and repeatedly implies it. And if transgender women are men, well, if that were true, then we would have no business going into a women's locker room or a bathroom, because men rape. Not all men, okay, sure, but all women have to worry about it. And that context is there. I'd like to know your opinion on this topic. I consider this to be a rather important discussion, and it might be kind of hard for you, but I would especially invite women to call in now. And as I said, I would like to speak with a trans excluding radical feminist, because I think we can work things out. 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And I'm going to go on with a different topic now, but that doesn't mean that you can't call in about any of the topics that I covered. But especially, like I said, I want to talk with you. I want to talk with you right now. I hope that you will undertake you will, you know, grab your courage and call in. 503-231-8187. Alternet has an article, pardon me, by Terrell Germain Starr on six ways white supremacy takes a toll on the mental health of black people. She writes, officially, Khalif Browder died as a result of suicide at his family's home in the Bronx this weekend, yet it's not a stretch to say the racist criminal justice system that locked him up for more than 3 years without a trial was likely the main culprit for the young man's death. In 2010, the cops arrested 16-year-old Browder after another teen accused him of robbing him of his backpack. Browder has always denied the accusations. His family couldn't afford $10,000 bail, so Browder was forced to, the 16-year-old, was forced to stay in Rikers for 3 years. While there, he was held in solitary confinement for 400 days, beaten by jail guards, abused, which this abused is what the author writes, Terrell Starr. In this context, it almost usually means rape. Almost usually, I mean, it usually means rape, abused by other inmates, and attempted suicide several times. Now, think of a 16-year-old, you know. Can you imagine this horror being inflicted on them on a false accusation of theft of a backpack? Black people make up just 14% of the U.S. population, yet 38% of those are locked up. According to a recent report, 60% of those in solitary confinement are black. And a fact sheet from Solitary Watch reports that solitary confinement can create or exacerbate mental health issues. Browder never had a chance. I think when they say black people, I think that might have been a typo, and they mean black teenage boys or black young men. Anyway, the number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Terry's on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
It's Terry. Yay. Well, I wanted to call you because this summer, I actually have... This whole topic has made me so sad in our queer community, and I've pretty much read a lot of things. I don't know if I can necessarily articulate all the things I've read because some of the things upset me, but I did read that article that you were referring to.
In the New York Times?
Yep, the New York Times. I read it online. And there were little points in that article that I could understand and relate to, and there were other things that I thought were pretty harsh and pretty cruel. And I think the piece that's hard for me in the queer community is specifically that there's so much kind of hate being said back and forth, and opinions that are not really compassionate or thinking of each other and thinking of kind of like how it is to live in the world as a dyke, as a non-gender conforming woman, or as a trans woman, and how we are really allies, and we can be allies, and we can still have our differences and agree differently, but kind of the name-calling has been really very intense. And I actually was called those names earlier this spring.
Which names?
I was called a TERF.
Okay.
And because I go to the Women's Music Festival in Michigan, and I have for 30 years, and I love that place, and I go there, and, you know, I've never really gotten into the political parts of festival because, you know, there's lots of people that have lots of different opinions, but I go there for specific reasons. And I have always felt that the festival was inclusive, and I love the group Trans Women Belong Here. They did great political work. I mean, there's been, like, lots of, like, many conversations within our community about how it's changed and what it's going to, and I'm of an older generation, so it's interesting to see how a younger generation feels differently about women's spaces and what that means, and does that include, and are we women, are we not women, and just the whole piece of it. So I had I did a fundraiser to raise money, because I've been going for 30 years, and it was before it was going to be the last year, and I wanted to have all women come, because I believe that all women should go and should experience it. And the things that were written about me on the internet were, specifically me, were really, like, very not true and were very hurtful and made me very nervous and made me, like, take precautions to protect myself because they were pretty violent and pretty hating. And,
you know, I really must thank you for having the guts to call in.
Yeah.
I've taken my stand, and you really... you know, had to take that leap and call in. I mean, that's terrific, and I'm really glad to be talking with you.
Thank you.
Do you think that some trans women are unaware of and have failed to drop the aggressive tactics that they have learned under patriarchy as men?
Sometimes that's what it feels like. It feels really misogynist.
I was talking about that sort of thing with a friend of mine, and one of the things that, she didn't counter that specifically with that, but something stuck in my mind when we were talking about Caitlyn Jenner and, mm-hmm. you know, Caitlyn's nails and her picture that was, you know, all dolled up on the cover of Vanity Fair. And she said, well, we shouldn't hold trans women to a higher standard than we hold women generally. And that kind of caught me up short because mm-hmm. I was just all ready to sneer at her for doing that and had complained to my doctor, for example, that, you know, wasn't really happy to be represented with someone who looked like a bonbon. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's the way it works out sometimes. I mean, I'm much happier to be, you know, represented in the press, so to speak, by Chelsea Manning.
Yeah. I think it was interesting. I think it's interesting too, is that, you know, I'm glad that she's done all these things, but it saddens me about that, you know, we have to look a specific way to conform to what we feel comfortable in. And that was really hard. Like that's hard. I mean, she obviously has privilege and money and, but when people were talking about Caitlyn Jenner, they were just talking about how beautiful she was. And I was like, wow, you're not going to talk about how athletic or, you know, all the different things that are aspects of her. It's just that she's beautiful. Because yeah, now
there's a lesson from womanhood for her right there.
I know. It was like, really, that's all you're going to all talk about is how pretty she is?
You know, I was
kind of bummed about that.
Yeah. That's the context. I wonder if this can help, that this can bring up a discussion. I'd like to see it bring up a discussion like this instead of the way it seems to be going right now. I mean, for example, I get out and I'm going to go drive my bus later, and I come into KBOO and I'm thinking, well, I look pretty good. You know, I check myself out and I shaved closely, for example. I've had more than 30 laser treatments, but the stubble still comes out. Mm-hmm. And you can see the stubble if you look. But I know that's not good enough. And if I don't want to be abused while driving the bus, I'm going to have to put cover on that stubble. And mm-hmm. I'm going to have to arch my brows just so. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have to manage my voice very carefully. And, mm-hmm. You know, all these things that I have to do. Otherwise, it becomes so stressful that I can, you know, serving the public is really, wouldn't have been my first choice as a transgender woman. But that's what I do. And that's what all women must suffer.
Mm-hmm. That is very true. And, you know, women grow beards.
Yeah.
Women have lots of facial hair. And why is it not acceptable to have facial hair? And when you do have facial hair, what do people do? They stare at you and they, you know, I think people looking different than what is supposed, you're supposed to look like. You know, I mean, dykes haven't shaved their legs or their underarms or have cut their hair short. And, you know, women have been not conforming to what, you know, traditional society says, if you're a woman, you look like this and you do these specific things. And that, and I think the one thing about girlhood, Teresa, that I want to say is that I was raised in a specific way, not that you weren't, but I was really raised to serve men.
Yeah.
I was raised in that way. And I think sometimes around saying that girlhood matters, because I find that, you know, 30, 40 years later, girls are still being raised that way. I mean, there is some differences and, you know, we've made lots of changes, but there's still some differences. We're still raised in that way.
Oh, absolutely. I could not agree more.
And so I think that it is important to honor women who've had girlhoods and to honor being a woman in this being female. We can just call it females, or I don't know how you want to say it, but
okay, so I'm glad that you brought that up, but isn't it true mm-hmm. that it's males and it's patriarchy and it's a society as a mm-hmm. whole that is not honoring girlhood rather than mm-hmm. a tiny number of transgender women?
I agree. I feel that if you're a woman, you know, come and do things with groups of women, and, you know, here you are. It's kind of like my friend who's a trans man. When he came out over 25 years ago, he would go to men's group, he had that, you know, this is who I am. And that's what I've experienced with women in their power is that they understand, you know, it's, I don't know if it's a power thing or how you would describe it, but I specifically in women's groups, if you're a woman, you come to the women. It's, you come to groups. This is what we're here for. And I think, not that it's that people don't, you know, pass as women or that they'd be judged, or I think there's so much conditioning of almost like timidness and like not being able to be in your power. Like me, I have fought for years to be in my power, to make equal wages, to be able to lift something, to be able to do something without any help. And I think for me, what I would like to see and what I have experienced with some of my transgendered women friends is that there's this knowingness, and maybe it comes with age or time or acceptance or whatever, there isn't any question. Does that make sense?
I think I understand, and it reminds me of when I was in Code Pink. Code Pink local chapter was very kind, and I asked them specifically, could they deal with the fact that I wanted to join them because I politically aligned with them and viewed myself as a woman, mm-hmm. and they said yes, and so I went, and I went to their meetings, and we had a grand time, and I was so happy, and I made good friends, and just great. A feeling that I can't get in other groups. But I left the group because after having several meetings and attending several events, I realized a couple of things. But one of them was that when I spoke, everyone shut up. And I had no such credibility. It was just, they were just reacting to my perceived maleness, even though they were being very open-minded. That effect happened every time. And so it got to where I wouldn't say anything, which is okay. You know, there's plenty of good thinking going in there. But I thought, you know, if every time I open my mouth, I'm going to, you know, hit the magnetic patriarchy button. It's just better that I'm not there. So
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, well, and you know, I can't blame them, and I can't blame me. It's just, you know, the times are not ripe for that to go over well. Now, it could have been that I could have taken the other attitude and just mentioned it every single time, you know, and joked with them. And I did joke with them somewhat, but I just couldn't stop it. I mean, they weren't trying to conform, but it's, as you say, finding your power is so hard when there's been so much and so intense intimidation in so many ways, including very physical ways. I think of the way my sister was treated compared to me. Breaking that, I just, you know, and that has applications for other oppressed groups as well, I'm sure. But yes, that is very, very strong, and I'm so glad that you brought it up.
Mm-hmm. So I think that there can be space for us all together. I think that people can choose whatever space they want to choose, and not exclude people, and we can work it out because in the queer community we have to.
Yeah.
We have to be kind and compassionate to each other. We have to talk to each other with openness, and we in some ways have to accept ourselves. And there is this one thing that keeps coming up that I keep reading and seeing is there's this kind of fear around women that women are being erased. Not that trans women are erasing women, but the way that kind of new generations are thinking about it. Like one of my experiences is that I will talk to women born female who don't identify as women, and I'm like, well, hello. You have these experiences as women that the society puts on you, and you just don't want to identify as a woman. You don't want to be a woman. You want to be. We used to call that androgyny, but we still honored, you know, being born female.
This is a great conversation. I think that's right as well. And you know, I, absent the context of the greater society, I simply refer to myself as an androgyne, which obviously I am, and I am. Actually, I'm physically an androgyne in addition to my, you know, corpus callosum and BST C3 and whatever that.
You've really gone over my head, Teresa. I don't really know what all those words mean.
Okay, I just mean configuration of my brain.
Okay.
Is obviously, you know, has feminine aspects to it. I mean, and the part that of my brain that has, that drove this is it keeps, you know, it tells me anytime I'm not consciously aware that my body must mature as female. I think someone else is waiting to speak. This has been a fantastic conversation. I thank you again for having the guts to call in after, you know, I'm trashing turfs. And one last thing, is the word turf then now an insult?
It seems to be an insult. I mean, in my experience is that in different communities have taken women that have, like, musicians and different things that they go. And anybody who actually goes to the festival, people have been calling them TERFs, or anybody who supports the festival, specifically the Michigan Women's Youth Festival, which makes me so sad because that's not my experience there, or my experience of some women I know that are trans that have gone for many years. But it's definitely an insult. And because what it was described, the description was, is that we wanted to terminate trans people. And that we burn effigies and throw our menstrual rags, and we want trans women to not be. It was the description of TERF that was described that I've read was pretty harsh and pretty negative and not.
Well, then I'm going to learn from that, and I'm going to change it right now. I'm not going to use that word.
And I would say, if you meet a woman who is a separatist, I mean, I consider myself a feminist for many years, and radical feminist. I mean, like, why has radical feminism now become a bad word? Like, radical meaning what?
Not for me. I don't consider it a bad word, but I think that's a good question. Why is that now bad? Because we do. I mean, radix from the root. We do need a radical feminism.
Well, I love your show. I listen to you sporadic, depending on when I'm driving. So I pulled over to this, and I'm very grateful that you've been on KBOO and support KBOO for as many years as you have and how out you've been. So,
well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And thanks for having a conversation. I'll talk to you anytime.
Awesome call. Okay, so I think someone else may be waiting online. Let me check with the engineer. And Jean is waiting to talk.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Jean.
Thank you. I'm responding to your request about 25, 30 minutes ago to have someone, a woman, call in.
Yes.
And you were talking about locker rooms and things.
Yes.
I'm maybe old school, and I'm not sure what would I see if you were in the locker room. We have women with double mastectomies. We have all kinds of different types of weirdly disfigured women from surgeries and things. So I'm not sure what I would see with you. Also, in a gym situation, even if it was a women's class, would I see somebody who was using, and excuse me for saying it this way, but like obscenely heavier weights than the women would normally use to strengthen their, because they use weights for different reasons than maybe men's muscles would be used for. So maybe you could just say a little bit about the physical aspects of what would happen in a woman's gym.
Well, I'll tell you all that I know from going into the gym there at TriMet. I go into the weight section. I occasionally see women there, but usually it's just men. And I also see that they're very unhappy with me being there. So I ignore them, and they ignore me. And yes, I lift heavier weights. Because I transitioned more than a decade ago, my upper body strength has largely left me. This leaves me concerned that, you know, especially since I am a bus driver, I do believe that there are certain self-defense moves that I need to be able to do efficiently. And so I go and get heavier weights than you can see women occasionally lifting weights this heavy, but it's very rare. And I lift them on purpose, and I'm aware that that's a male gesture. And I just think, well, that's just the way it's going to be because of who I am and where I work.
Right. Sure.
And then going into the locker room, I am careful not to show anything below my waist. I have much more fully developed breasts than most trans women. I don't mind showing those, but I even kind of avoid that. Really, I just try to have as little attention as possible unless someone greets me, and then I cheerily greet them. And when I need to take a shower, no one sees anything because there's a shower curtain.
Well, okay. Well, I see that you would not be a problem in the gym that I would go to then. Thank you for sharing that.
Thanks for calling in. Well, it sounds like I've run out of time for this program. I believe that Chris Andre is next with Air Cascadia here on the KBOO Airwaves. I know that you will want to stay tuned and listened to that. Chris Andre, who I cannot praise enough for the many things that she has done, including defeating pipeline projects through here that would have greatly contributed to global warming and trashed our forests, and she is still on the beam with that sort of project. That's the sort of radio programming we here at KBOO are proud of. You've been listening to Press Watch, and I am Teresa Mitchell, broadcasting to you on 90.7 FM from the Big Tower on the West Hills and other frequencies in the Cascadian area and via the World Wide Web on KBOO.FM, where you can click the tip jar to contribute, and via the World Wide Web to all the ships at sea.
And good morning from KBOO Portland, 1 minute before 10 o'clock. We're about 15 minutes away from Flashpoints. We've got investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we'll hear the latest news about Texas and their most restrictive abortion legislation to date, HB2. We'll also talk about the recent revelations by Caitlyn Jenner, and we'll hear part 13 of our series, The Battle for Public Education. At 11, we'll hear Between the Covers with host Lisa Loving. Today's guest is Stacey Wakefield, author of the new novel, The Sunshine Crust Baking Factory. And at 11:30, it's Words in Pictures with host S.W. Conser. Today's guest is local artist Philip Barash, who exhibits his large-scale oil paintings at Portland area galleries and industrial spaces, and then adapts the panels into card sets and sequential narratives. That's all coming up, but first, it's Air Cascadia with host Chris Andre, with headlines, news, interviews, and commentary. That's coming up next on KBOO.
Join us for the KBOO Community Radio Monthly Film Night at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll be showing the film Death Metal Angola on Thursday, June 11th at 7 p.m. This documentary traces how death metal has taken root in the Southwest African country of Angola, with its history of war and civil unrest. Creating something new is an act of defiance in the face of destruction. Again, that's Death Metal Angola at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.